When Joe West first originally contacted me here at Stateville Prison, I was on a visit. The counselor came in to the visiting room where I was at and stated that she wanted me to come out and make a phone call. I told her, I said, no way. I'm here 365 days a year. I'm not leaving my visit to go make a phone call. I said, who's calling? She told me, someone from Texas named Joe West. I told him, I do not know the party. I said, tell them I'll call them on my time, not their time. I'm on a visit. Don't bother me when I'm on a visit. The next day, they come, got me out of my cell. They took me downstairs and got a phone call hooked up. I called Joe West to talk to him. I told him, you have 3 minutes to convince me why I should talk to you. As Joe started talking to me, I told him, I said, whoa, stop. I said, you're on a lot of touchy spots. I said, these phone calls are recorded. Every phone call going in and coming out is recorded. If you want to talk to me that bad, then I suggest you come and visit me. Joe West had me put him on his visiting list. He come up to visit me. He spent 2 days up here talking with me. The first day, I wouldn't even talk to him about the Kennedy situation. We got into sports, weather, generally about prison, local things, till I got comfortable with him. The next day, after I thought it over all night, Joe S. seemed like a pretty nice guy. I really liked Joe. He had a magnetism about him. The next day, we sat down, we got serious, and then we started talking. I sit in the dining or in the visiting room with Joe. They gave us a pencil and paper. I sketched the entire Lilly Plaza out for him without any maps, without any pictures, nothing present. And I explained to Joe at that time, because Joe wanted to know where was I at. And I said, I'm going to put an X on the paper to signify me, but this X is not in the correct spot. I said, when the time comes, then I will put the X where it is supposed to be.
What had you told him to know that that you were on the plot?
Pardon me?
What had you told him that Joe knew you were on the plot?
Oh, I asked him. He said that someone had informed him that I was there. He said he had a reliable source. And I didn't know for quite a while who that source was. It was quite some time later before I learned the fact that the FBI was aware of my presence as early as 1964. Because I never knew that anyone ever knew about me. But Zach Sheldon, from what I understand, and I'm only quoting this from hearsay, that Zach was the one that stated and gave me to Joe West the information on me, that I was in Dealey Plaza.
That's my understanding.
Mm-hmm.
Did you ever actually confess to taking a shot to Joe West?
No, I never did.
I'd make a statement.
I never. Well, the whole thing is, like with Joe West, Joe West died. He passed away, never knowing that I was one of two shooters there in Dealey Plaza that day. Joe West never knew I was on the grassy knoll.
Do you have any thoughts on his death? Do you think that was natural?
Joe West went in for heart surgery, and from what I was told and what I understood, that he had come through it fairly well, and he was on the road to recovery. But then I was informed there was complications with his medicine. He was allergic to it, or an allergy or something. He swallowed it, they killed him. The medication killed him. A couple of years ago, maybe a year and a half ago, I heard through the grapevine, and I won't go into the party that brought this information to me, they said that someone had tampered with Joe's medication, and he had received the wrong medication because they wanted to silence him.
That's what his wife.
Yeah.
Thinks. Okay.
Why would they want to silence him?
We had I would say Joe West had the case in court. He wanted to exhume John F. Kennedy's body. And that's what he was fighting for. And at this point, when I talked to Joe West, I explained to him that John F. Kennedy had been hit in the head with a mercury round, a special load. At this point, explained to him, he can use this in the courts to have the body exhumed because there would still be traces of mercury because the traces of mercury do not disappear. It'll always be there. And so this is what Joe West wanted, to go back with more evidence and use this to get Kennedy's body exhumed, to look for traces of mercury.
And the court had accepted his case.
The court had accepted his case. But with his death, the case died.
Did you actually meet there with Oliver Stone?
I met Oliver Stone 3 times. Matter of fact, I have a paper that Bob Vernon had Oliver Stone sign. Now, Bob Vernon come in after the Joe West deal. Bob Vernon took over for Joe West. Bob Vernon met with Oliver Stone, and he had him sign an agreement where they wanted to get me on film, but I refused to do that. I met with Oliver Stone 3 times.
And you never told him your story?
No, I did not tell Oliver Stone my story. I refused to discuss it with him. And like I said, I've got a copy of this thing. I got Oliver Stone's signature. Bob Bernard's the only signature on it. It states what it's all about. The only thing missing is my signature, because I would never sign that paper for the agreement.
Why was that?
I didn't like the man.
Case closed.
And if you'd like, I'd be more than happy to send you a copy of the document. And it's got Oliver Stone's original signature on it. And it has Bob Vernon's signature on it.
Well, I've got a raft of questions, but I'll tell you what, let's just go back to, and just let's go in chronology. Just tell me your own account again. You understand what we're really doing here is because the interview you gave Bob Vernon is kind of tied up in all kinds of legal stuff, right?
Yes.
And to help you and Pam, we're redoing this thing so that we can put that aside and move on.
Okay.
So this is redundant, but let's move on. Go back to when you first learned that there was a plot to kill Kennedy, and then just bring us forward into how it all came about.
Excuse me. The first time that I knew about anything being planned on Kennedy, I'd heard a lot of rumors that nobody liked Kennedy. They wanted to kill Kennedy. They wanted to assassinate him. They wanted to do everything to the man.
Were you kind of upset with him yourself over the Bay of
Pigs? Oh, I was upset with him over the Bay of Pigs, but I never paid any attention to any of this at first because, you know, everybody talks. Somebody gets mad at somebody right away, and I'm going to take this guy out. I'm going to take that person out. Woo, 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 woo. You know, a lot of barking, junkyard dogs barking, you know. But I was sitting in the Harlow Grill that evening playing the pinball machine, not the flipper kind, the kind of numbers where you gamble on and you put about $10 in to play a game. And Charles Nicoletti walked in. Man that I did a lot of work with, man that I respected. And he walked in the back room where I was at. He says, "Jimmy, let's go." I said, "I'll be with you in a minute." He reached over and tilted the machine and said, "Let's go now." My reply was, "Yes, sir, Mr. Nicoletti." I knew he wasn't in no mood to wait and hang around. He said, "I want to talk to you." I went out, I got in this car, and we went for a ride. And we made it a basic habit not to sit around restaurants, talk, reels, discuss anything like that, because we wanted other people hearing. And we went for a ride, and he told me, he says, "We're going to do a friend of yours." And I said, "Jesus, what the hell did he do now?" But I thought this was referring to one of my friends in town there. He had been robbing the pinball machines and the cigarette machines, and he had a $1,000-a-day heroin habit. And he was an all-out-and-out junkie, and, you know, they'd beat him up several times and everything else and threatened him, but so far they'd never went as far as to kill him. Chuck laughed at me, and he says, "No," he says, "not him." He says, "I'm talking about President Kennedy, JFK. And I looked at him, and I said, "What?" He says, "JFK. He says, "Your buddy." I said, "Well, he just busting, you know, giving me a hard time, but he knew JFK. He knew how much I disliked the man." As I looked at him, and I laughed. I said, "Okay, fine. Fine with me. You getting arguments there?" And at this point, I still kind of thought, you know, he was just joking with me. But then he got real serious about it. And then we started talking, and he told me, he says, "What I'm going to want you to do," he said, "I'm going to look around." He says, "We'll search the area around the town here." He says, "You know everything pretty good," he says, "and see what before we're going to do it at, what kind of weapons we're going to need, and other things like that," he says. And he mentioned, he said, he was going to bring Johnny Roselli in on it. Fine with me, you know, I don't care who we work with. You know, I like Johnny. I had no problems with him. And originally we'd planned to do it in the Chicago area, but certain people didn't like that idea. So then we put it off, and this is like 6 months before the assassination ever really took place.
But you were not supposed to be a shooter?
Oh, no, never. I was not a shooter. I was, let's put it this way. I would like, you know, the gopher. I go for this, go for that, pick this up, pick that up, run around, drive him around. When Chuck went somewhere, I was always with him. And
did you ever get wind that the Secret Service might have found out about the plot in Chicago?
No, I didn't get no wind on that at all, no drift. I just knew that certain people high up in organized crime, they wasn't too happy about the idea of having something like that happen to that magnitude in their backyard.
Gotcha.
Because they figured Bobby would really be down there, you know, and they already had their own little private wars going. And so we decided, well, we'll take it moving. So I had no idea it was going to Texas at that point. This come to me down the road.
About when was that?
Well, I'm going to say probably, 2.5-3 months maybe before I ever made the trip to Texas that they were talking about it. Because they didn't know where he was going to go. They were looking for an area to go. But then they had heard that he possibly may take this trip to Texas, but there was nothing definite. And I didn't go to Texas until that had been confirmed. And they had several different locations. There was New Orleans and I don't know, there's other places he was going to. But When it come down to it, I had been told there was places that they had planned to do it. Other people had been authorized, you know, stuff like that. Just different rumors you hear. How much credibility is to it, I cannot say. But when the time come, and we knew that it was going to be serious, and we were going to, Chuck was sending me to Texas. That's when I went down on Bellman Avenue, the old Valley place where they made the pinball machines. And I had a shed down there, a place where we, back room. That was all owned by the outfit, too, pinball machines. I kept a catch of weapons down there. We used to do a lot of work. And when I say we, I'm referring to a party named Wolfman, who is now deceased. But at that time, he was excellent, remodifying weapons, manufacturing loads, whatever come down to handguns, rifles. This guy was a professional at it. He could manufacture things in his basement like you wouldn't believe, from silencers on down the line. He did it all for him. So I went down there, got the stuff we needed, and we had the one car that he just bought. Already had everything secured in. We had secret compartments in it. And every car that we had, even before the 63 Chevy, even in the 61 Ford that we had prior to that, in the 62, we had compartments in the dash where you could reach up under it, open things up, put grenades in there, handguns, whatever we might need, behind the back seat. We had gun racks in the cars. We had pull-off door panels that would snap off. You could put them back on. We had handguns and stuff in there, whatever you might need. But we always had a work car ready.
So what did Wolfman do for you?
Wolfman, when I contacted him after all this went down, and this is several years later, this is when I first met Joe West, and Joe West had come here, visited me, we talked, and he asked me, he said, do you think this party called Wolfman would talk to me? And Joe asked me what his real name was, and I told him, I said, I won't divulge that, but I will call him and talk to him. So I called him on the phone, and I told him, I said, I'm talking to Joe West from Texas, and he wanted to know who Joe was, and I explained all this to him, and I said, Joe would very much like to interview. I said, I did not give Joe West your name, but I told him that you was the one that manufactured the special round. You made 6 rounds for me to take to Texas, all mercury loaded. I said, he wants to talk to you very much. Will you talk with him? And he said, get back to him. He said, I'll let you know. He said, I want to check a few things. The following week, Wolfman was dead.
How did he die?
I believe he had a heart attack. I've been in contact with nobody that was affiliated with Wolfman since that day.
Tell me about these mercury loads. Can you describe them for just a layperson?
Well, it was a 22 round, and he took the tips out. He drilled them out. Then he inserted with an eyedropper. He put mercury into the end of the round, and he resealed them with wax. This is to make them explode on impact.
Okay. So now you've got, and describe the car.
The car was a 63 Chevy Tudor Burgundy, Chevy Impala.
With the special compartments.
Oh, we had the special compartment, the dash. We had the back seat, you could take that off, pull the bottom part out, then you raise the back up, snap it off, the little clamps, take that out. We had the springs removed in the behind the seat there by it, and we had little racks welded in there so we could mount weapons in there.
Okay, so now you got your weapons, you got your loads, you got your car. How did it come together after that?
Well, just before I left, final instructions was, Chuck told me, he said, I want you to leave first thing in the morning. He says, and I don't want you driving at night. He said, I want you on the highway with a lot of traffic during daytime where nobody pays any attention to you.
Let's go back. Give me a date or approximate date.
I don't remember the approximate date, but I went down like a week before the assassination. Okay. I want to say I was in Dallas area 5 days before the assassination took place.
And what was the purpose of that?
The purpose of that was for me to go to Dallas, look over the area, learn dead-end streets, railroad crossings, time for train crossings. They already knew the regular motorcade route that he would be taking, and they had already looked that over, and they wanted to see if there's any better places, and a lot of people had already decided on. I'm not the one that chose Dealey Plaza, but I was told to look it over very close and look and see if I thought there's any other place better. And I did the whole area from the route they had. All the way through, I had Lee Harvey Oswald with me.
All right, go back now. So about a week ahead of time, I think it was a Monday, as I recall.
Something, I'm not sure.
Okay, yeah. But you left Chicago. Just start. You left Chicago, you went to?
No, I didn't leave on a Monday. I left either Thursday morning or Friday. I don't remember which. I know I was in Mesquite, Texas, Saturday morning. Okay. But that's when Lee Harvey Oswald showed up at the motel where I was at. I arrived there on a Friday. I'm pretty sure it was Friday when I arrived there.
Did you call anybody when you got to Dallas?
I made 2 telephone calls when I got there. I called Charles Nicoletti, told him that I was on the scene, and where I was at, in case he had to reach me. I turned around and made another phone call. I called David Atlee Phillips. I had a number to call. The call was put through to David Phillips. and he was notified where I was at, because I had not told him in advance that I was going to Dallas, Texas.
And why did you call David Atlee, Philip?
Because he always said to know where I was at, because he was my controller.
For?
CI purposes, special operations, or something that might be needed done.
And you were supposed to stay in contact with him?
We always stayed in contact. We had numbers to call.
What happened after that?
He said, thank you, and let it go at that. We didn't have any great discussion on the phone. I told him where I was at, the location, and through David Atlee Phillips is the only way that Lee Harvey Oswald could have known where I was at. But I had called no one else. I made two phone calls.
Where were you staying?
I was staying at the Lamplighter Inn right there in Mesquite, Texas.
And then the next thing you knew, Lee Harvey Oswald showed up.
The following morning, Lee Harvey Oswald was there. When he knocked on the door, I opened the door and I was shocked to see him, because I didn't think anybody knew where I was at except for the other two people.
Why is Phillips the only one who could have sent Lee Harvey Oswald?
Because Charles Nicoletti had never met Lee Harvey Oswald.
He didn't know him.
He did not know him.
You say you were shocked to see him, but did you know Lee Harvey Oswald?
I had known Lee Harvey Oswald prior to that, yes.
How'd you know him?
I knew him from earlier operation that we was on with David Phillips when I was running semi-automatic 45 caliber submachine guns down to Clinton, Louisiana. They were made, I think they were manufactured by Knoxville Arms. They were not the old Thompson. They looked like a Thompson submachine gun, but they were not Thompson. They were only semi-automatic. And they were very cheaply made.
And how did you meet Lee Harvey Oswald?
I met Lee Harvey Oswald through David Atlee Phillips. When I got down there, he introduced me to Lee.
Was it your understanding that Phillips was also Oswald's CIA contact?
I learned that when I was down there. That is the first time he introduced me to Lee Harvey Oswald, and he also instructed me that Lee could be trusted and that he was Lee's controller.
He made that as a statement.
He made it as a statement, because I wanted to know who he was dealing with and who I was giving weapons to.
I need you to make a statement that I was introduced by Phillips, and who was my CIA handler, and I was told that he was Oswald's.
We didn't call them handlers back then. We called them controllers.
Okay.
David Atlee Phillips, he introduced me to Lee Harvey Oswald. And upon doing this, he also explained to me that he was Lee Harvey Oswald's controller, the same as he was mine, that he was always in contact with Lee Harvey Oswald.
So that's how you know that's where the word came for Oswald to come meet you in Dallas.
So that, through common sense, tells me the only one that could have sent Lee Harvey Oswald to me was David Atlee Phillips. And when I opened the door and Oswald was there, I was kind of shocked to see him, because I didn't know that he knew I was there. And so I asked Lee, I says, what the hell are you doing here? Because I was shocked, you know. I said, I was advised to drop by and spend some time with you and see if I could help you out. I said, help me out? He said, yes. He says, somebody wants me to show you the area. And I said, okay. I said, come on in. So he coming in. So we sit down and we talked. And I said, I'll be with you in a few minutes. And I was young and cocky at that time. And I'd just come out of the shower and everything. And I was combing my hair. So I had a camera there. So I told Lee, hey, make a couple of pictures while I'm here in Texas. And so Oswald made a couple of pictures of me. And then he said, let me have the film. I'll get it developed. I said, no. I said, I get the whole roll of film. So that was how I got a couple of pictures made that people have recently asked me about.
But, whose camera was it, yours or
my yours? Camera.
Your camera.
Yeah. But he was going to take the film, turn him in, get it developed. But I said, no.
Didn't want to let that film go.
I do my own work.
How did he arrive at the motel?
He arrived driving a Blue Falcon, Ford Falcon.
You remember what year model?
No, I don't. It wasn't brand new. It was a couple of years old.
So he could drive?
Yes, he could drive. When he met me in Clinton, Louisiana, he drove up in a, I want to say Chevrolet truck. It could have been a Ford. I'm going to say pickup. It was a pickup truck. Let me put it that way. It was an old pickup truck. And we put the weapons in the back end of it and pulled the tarp down over the weapons.
What color? Do you remember what color pickup?
I believe it was green. It was a real, I don't know, dirty, yucky green, whatever you want to call it, darker green, like, you know. It hadn't been washed in a long time, and there's a lot of rust on it. That's about the best way to describe it.
So did you and Lee Oswald drive around Dallas then?
We drove around Dallas. Lee Harvey Oswald and I, we drove around Dallas for 5 days up till right before the assassination. I did not see Lee Harvey Oswald on the morning of the assassination. But prior to that, Lee Harvey Oswald had been with me every day. We drove around. He showed me different streets, different areas. He was the one that took me out to the place southeast of Mesquite there, next to a big junkyard. We went out there in the field. He said, ain't nobody going to bother you out here, you know, because I wanted to calibrate the scopes for the, not only for the fireball, but for other weapons as well. And while I was out there firing weapons and ejecting shell casings, Lee was picking them up and holding them in his hand. But I didn't want to leave no casings or nothing behind, and I'm busy firing, so I looked at Lee, grab them casings. And that's what he did. He picked them and he held on to them until we got released. I calibrated my scopes, set things up, put the stuff back in the car, and we got back in. We went riding around, and I wanted to know the railroad crossings. I wanted to wait and see what time trains come through. I want to know if there's any passengers, if there was freight trains. They stopped. The track's going to be blocked. The intersection's going to be blocked. Dead-end streets, construction work, wherever the intersection was at, where all the lights were at, how long the lights were. They stayed red. I wanted all these little details.
Did anybody show up or give you any static while you were out there sighting in those weapons?
No, nobody. When I was test firing the weapons, nobody at all even come out there, looked at me. And there wasn't any house or nobody real close by. We're off the main highway there. And like I say, it was just, you know, nobody come around. Nobody even cared.
No, back, I remember back then we'd go out on Turtle Creek and shoot turtles. Yeah. And nobody, cops, nobody showed up.
How much time were you two together during the day?
We was out there test firing. We were test firing weapons for approximately, I'm going to say 20, 30 minutes. But during the day, we probably spent anywhere from 5 hours, 6 hours together.
So all that time, he could not have been working in the Texas School Depository?
No. Right? He worked in the book depository stores, what he told me. I was never in that place. But he had time off to come out and spend time with me, and then I would drop him off in the area, and he would go somewhere, and I guess that's where he went. I had never asked him where he went, what he done, who he saw.
So that must have been a cover job then.
Yeah.
Okay, so it gets to be, say, Thursday before the assassination. How did it all come down?
That Thursday, I went on back to the motel. I dropped him off that afternoon. I went on back out to the motel to get some rest. And the following morning, I'd gotten a message that I was supposed to call Leo at the, I think it was the Dallas Cabana. And I called over there and answered the phone to Leo because Mr. Nicoletti didn't want his name used. I knew he'd come in late. I didn't know when he come in. I didn't know how he got there. But when I come in, I was told to come over there and park and that Johnny Roselli would come down. He wanted me to drive Johnny Roselli to Fort Worth. I pull up out front and waited. He come down a few minutes after I pulled up. I never went in the hotel, never asked for anybody. He come down and come outside because he knew I was en route. And I drove from there to Fort Worth, Texas with Johnny Roselli in the car.
So that was Mr. Nicoletti went with you?
No, Mr. Nicoletti did not go.
Just Roselli?
Just Johnny Roselli went with me to Fort Worth.
Did you know Johnny Roselli prior to that day?
I had met Johnny Roselli before. I'd met him in Florida, Miami.
Any jobs with him?
Never any jobs with him. I'd talk with him and around, but we never, we was probably involved in some of the same operations or things, but with the same people, but we never went out and did anything together.
Were you aware that Roselli was working with the government in an anti-Castro?
Yes, I was well aware of that. He was, I was well aware that Johnny Roselli was involved in the government actions. He was like the liaison between CIA and organized crime. And he was heavily involved in the invasion of Cuba, Bay of Pigs, Chiano's Bay, whichever you prefer to call it. But he was also very tight with Frank Sturgis. Frank Sturgis headed up the SAO, which is the secret army organization, what this is all about. And they've had so many different code names for wanting to kill Castro, I couldn't even name half of them. But every time you turned around, somebody had a new operation going. But Jen...
I'm sorry, do you ever hear Mr. Roselli as called Colonel, or did he have any military credentials?
I don't remember what the total name was. I know he was called Colonel once in a while. I can't remember the name of it. I know he was called Colonel. But that was, as far as I know, Johnny Roselli never held any rank of any kind. But, like I say, he was, and Bob Tebler, the CIA, he was liaisoned between them. What his actual part was, I don't know, but I know he was heavily involved with them and all through that.
I think it was Ralston, Colonel.
Yeah, Ralston, that's it. Colonel Ralston. That's what they call him, Colonel Ralston.
Okay. So tell us about the trip over to Fort Worth.
The trip over to Fort Worth? Well, I didn't know we were going to Fort Worth. He told me, and he had directions, and I don't know if he'd ever been there before or not. But we went through Fort Worth. I remember the exit was, when the exit really is like University Avenue or University Boulevard, the name University, that's all I know. And I know it was on the south side, and then it sat on the west side of that street. Just a couple blocks off, and there was a pancake house, fairly new one.
Did you know it's still there?
No, I didn't know it's still there, but it's been there long. I guess they made good pancakes, I know that. True. But that's where I had my first Belgium waffle.
Hmm. Why did you go all the way to Fort Worth?
And excuse me, I got to clarify one thing. I didn't have a Belgium waffle that morning. I had the Belgium waffle there a few years later. But that morning when I got there, Johnny Roselli went there to meet somebody by the name of Jack Ruby. I had never knew Jack Ruby, nothing about him. When I got there and pulled into the parking lot, Johnny Roselli told me, he said, let me go in first, see where I'm going to sit, come in, position yourself. And he asked me, he said, are you carrying? And I said, yeah, I'm carrying. He says, good. He says, when I sit down where I'm sitting at, he said, I don't know what may transpire. He said, something could go wrong. He said, but be very alert. He said, keep my backside covered. He said, I won't be in your line of fire. And I said, okay, I pick an open field of fire. I says, wherever I figure I can handle it. I said, I'll go sit down, I'll come in position myself. Johnny Roselli went in and they had like, you'd call it a booth at the table sitting there, you know, it wasn't bolted to the floor or nothing. But he sat down in that and I went in shortly right behind him. I positioned myself at the counter, ordered a cup of coffee, was served and sit there. And then I sit there and I watched until short, stocky built man come in, walked over, Johnny got up, they shook hands, they sit down, they talked for a couple of minutes. I seen him take like a half size, like a legal envelope, but only half that size, out of his jacket, and he pushed it across the table to Johnny Roselli. He got up, they shook hands. This man left. Johnny waited maybe 2 minutes. Johnny looked at me. I got up. I walked out of the restaurant, made sure the area's clear, nobody outside in the parking lot. I went over, got in the car, started up. I pulled up by the door. Johnny Roselli walked out, got in the car, and we drove away.
Did you ask him or did you find out in some way what was in the envelope?
On the way back to Dallas, Johnny and me was riding down the road. He didn't open the envelope right away. We got almost to, I think it's Arlington, it's about halfway there. I'm saying halfway, it could be less one way or the other. Been a long time for me. But we was right about Arlington. And Johnny opened the envelope up and started taking stuff out and looking at it. Excuse me. He's looking at it, I'm noticing over, I'm watching over while I'm driving, and he's got these little black wallets, like half-size, like identification wallets, and he opened them up, and there's identification plates in them, and there's badges in them. At that point, I didn't know what the identification on it was, because he's sitting there looking at it, and I'm not going to lead over, I'm not going to say, give me one of those or anything like that. I'll wait when they want me to know, he'll tell me. And then he opened up a piece of paper, and he unfolded it. And there's been a lot of discrepancy over this part now. But Johnny Roselli said they only made one change in the route.
It was
a map of Dealey Plaza, the motor key route. When he looked at it for Dealey Plaza, he said they've only made one alter, one change in it. He said, that's all. And I said, what's that? And he said, they're going to go down Elm Street. So they're going to stop and make a detour and come around this little street here. And he held it up and I kind of glanced over at it, but I didn't get a chance to look at it real good at that point. But I already had reconned the area, so I knew what he was talking about. And I know everybody says, well, the matter that they had the motorcade in the newspaper weeks and months ahead of time. True, they did, but they didn't have that one change. And anybody wants to show somebody a newspaper clipping, they better check it real close because the original route, they was not coming down Elm Street there on that little detour where they had to slow down.
Had you heard prior to that that the when they got to Dealey Plaza that they would just continue straight on down Main Street? Was that the idea?
The original plan was that we'd be shooting at a fast-moving target, and Nicoletti had no military experience, and I already had advised him that he would have to shoot high and the target would be going away from him, that he would have to shoot above the head. And we were going for a headshot, and I told him, it's going to be hard for you to get from there. And we're getting a little bit ahead, though. Before we got into this part,
yeah. Let's go back.
Because Chuck hadn't got to Dallas that week. He only come in, I'd seen him that morning. I hadn't seen Chuck in person until I went with Johnny Roselli to Fort Worth and come back. Johnny Roselli got out of the car, went upstairs. Charles Nicoletti come down. Mr. Nicoletti got in the car with me, and we drove to Dealey Plaza.
All right, back up a half second. How did Roselli get to Dallas?
At that point, Roselli, he mentioned to me, Johnny Roselli, we was on the way to Fort Worth, and I asked him, he said, when'd you get in? He said, I got in this morning. He said, I got in early this morning. He said, I hadn't been here a couple hours. And I said, how'd you get in? And he said he got lucky. He caught a ride on a plane that's sponsored by the Central Intelligence Agency, the CIA. I said, how the hell did you manage that one? He said, I got lucky. He's had somebody there. I didn't ask no more. He didn't elaborate any more than that. I didn't dig any deeper than that.
He didn't mention the board team at that time?
Not at that point.
Okay.
So we got all that. Now then, when we get back, I still don't know that he's there on an abort mission. I have no knowledge of that at this point of the game. Johnny Roselli got out of the car, went back in the hotel. I waited maybe 5 to 7 minutes for Charles Nicoletti to come down. When he got down, Mr. Nicoletti got in the car with me and said, let's go. We took off. I said, where to? He said, take me over by the plaza. We went over. We parked. It's drizzling rain. We get out. We're walking around. This is the first time that Johnny or that Charles Nicoletti has even mentioned to me about an abort team. And he asked me.
What did he say?
While we're walking around, he asked John Charles Nicoletti asked me. He says, how do you feel about being backup? I said, what do you mean backup? He says, how would you feel about being backup as a shooter for me? I said, what happened to Johnny? What's with Johnny? And he said, Johnny's a little bit paranoid on this. He says, the CA's called a hit off. He said, they don't want the hit to go down. And I said, well, what'd you say? Chuck's exact words were, fuck them, it's going anyway. And I told him, I said, well, what about Johnny? He said, well, Johnny will be with me, he says, but he's not going to be a shooter. He said, he doesn't want to go against the orders. He said, he's been told he flew in here specifically to abort this assassination.
Did he say he got cold feet?
No. When we was talking, when I asked him about Johnny Roselli, I said, how come Johnny's not going to be a shooter? He said, well, he doesn't want to go against the orders of the CIA. He said, what he wants is that he wants to call off. He said, he flew in here as an abort team. He said, they flew a plane here specially with him on it to tell us to call it off. And so I asked him at that point, I said, what'd you say? He said, I said, fuck him, it's a go. He said, we're going to do it. He said, Jimmy, he says, you know we can't call this off. Only one man can stop it. He said, and he's here. If he wants us to stop it, he said, he'll notify me. He said, I'm not going on somebody else's word. He said, as poor as it is right now, I have a go. He says, from the boss. He says, we're going.
Now, who was the one man that could have stopped it?
There was only one man. Charles Nicoletti did not say his name at that point. He just said the boss. I knew he was referring to. He was referring to Sam Giancana.
Who was he?
Sam Giancana. He was the number two man at that time. A lot of people's going to tell you he was number one, but not true. Tony Accardo was still running things. He turned things over. He had Sam Giancana running all this operation, everything, but Tony Accardo was still the man, and he was still calling the shots on whatever went down, whatever was done.
So anything Giancana said had to at least have the okay of...
It had to be sanctioned, and it had to come through Tony Accardo.
We're talking about the Chicago crime.
We're talking about only the Chicago area alone.
Now, there's a question right there. To your knowledge, was there involvement of any other crime families, Marcello, Trafficante?
I knew of no other crime family being involved. I heard rumors, but do I know if anybody else was involved? No, I do not know if anybody else was involved.
Okay.
They would have been out of character for them to even notify me about that or anybody else. That only stays up in the higher ranks of the family or the people or the crime family, whoever you wish to describe it. And when things are handed out, like different departments, different people get different things. Somebody might be into bookmaking. Somebody handles the bookmaking. They pass that out to one party. This party, he distributed amongst the people in the area because everybody's got a little, what we call territory at that time. And somebody else might be into loan sharking. And you might have somebody running Cardi theft. You might have somebody else running chop shops, which eventually I got into, which led to my federal prison sentence. But when it come down to murder contracts, that was a whole new thing. Then we had somebody else to handle the liquor license. But everything was distributed amongst different people. And whatever moved, including the garbage at that time. Even the garbage was controlled by the outfit. And one party, and this can all be confirmed. I believe he's still alive. He's very old now. But his name was Zaccaro. He had the garbage pickup at that time there. And he was strictly informed that if he picked up another can of garbage, he would be in his next garbage truck going out to the dump. They took over his business, and then he went into the junkyard business. And later on down the road, he became involved in a place out in Elk Grove Village, a very big place called Globe Auto Wreckers.
Okay.
So his son's now running.
So once Mr. Nicoletti said, we're going anyway, what happened then?
That's when he asked.
Yeah, about what time?
This would be approximately 10:30.
Statement.
Yeah.
This here would be approximately 10:30 a.m., about 10:30 a.m., Mr. Nicoletti told me he asked me to be the backup shooter. And that was the first inkling of anything that I would ever be involved in the assassination itself. Prior to that, I was only know the area and transport weapons.
Was the weather clearing by that time?
It had started to clear. It started clearing about 10:45, I believe, the best I can remember. I could be off a few minutes. I know it had been drizzling rain. It was cold. It was damp. Sun didn't come out until, after 11 a.m., I believe. But like I said, again, I could be off a few minutes on it. This is a long time ago.
They say the knees go first.
Yeah.
Okay, so the weather's clearing. It's about 10 or so. Proceed. What happened?
And I told Johnny, I said, yes, I'd be honored. I told Mr. Nicoletti, I said, I would be honored to back you on it. I said, anything you ask, I'll do. And so he told me, and most of this had already been prearranged beyond my knowledge. But this plaza had been selected. I didn't select it. Someone else already selected it. And he asked me where I thought it would be the best place for him. And I told him the Dow Tech building. Because the Dow Tech building gave him a better shot with him taking the straight run through at a high rate of speed. And evidently, I'm quite certain that they had all this prearranged on that part of it. Is that place is his location, and for him and Johnny, as far as that goes. Because they already had made an arrangement to be admitted into the building.
Why do you think he checked that with you then? Why
did he? He didn't check it. He just asked my opinion. He has always questioned me about different things. He used me like a sounding board. Like maybe, you're in business, you're in the office, you might ask one of your people around you, what do you think about this? You don't really care what he thinks. You're just asking for an opinion to see what he thinks. Maybe you overlook something, or maybe somebody's got a better idea than you do at this time of the game.
Could it also be that you had military training and experience with Nicholas?
Well, that's possible. He respected me for my knowledge of weapons, my knowledge of knowing terrain, because I'd been in combat. And the first thing you walk into an area is, to you it's a landscape. To me it's terrain. Because if I walk in and I walk into an ambush, I want to know where the low spots are, the high spots are, where all the coverage is. I got to know where I can get my rear end down so I don't get a shot off. You got to have a place to go to ground in a hurry. You cannot afford to stand around and be looking around and wondering, gee, where can I go from here? You do, you're dead. You got to think. That's why you take all this training in the military. You're trained not to think, but to react.
But Mr. Nicoletti had never been in the military, had he?
Not to my knowledge. He had never served a day in the Army or any military service, as far as that goes.
Where did you serve?
I was in the Army, 82nd Airborne. I took my basic at Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri. I took my AIT at Fort Polk. They screwed up my orders. I went to Fort Sills and laid there for about a week, maybe 10 days. From there, I went to Fort Bragg to go airborne. I won the service in January of 1959.
And where were you assigned?
When I left, we left, I believe it was July the 10th. We went from there to Laos. We was on an operation called Operation White Star. A handful of military advisors were going over to train people in Laos there to do certain operations. At that time, it really wasn't supposed to be any black bag stuff or anything. We were just going there to train and equip people. And I found a lot of it pretty hilarious. As we armed a lot of them, we gave them weapons, and they all took the stuff, and they all ran up north, and we had to fight them later. But that's how we basically done things all the way through the years in history.
Did they call it counterinsurgency at that time?
Oh, yeah, they call it counterinsurgency. What I found the most amazing was always the place called Vietnam, just outside of Vietnam. Not Vietnam, don't get it confused. This is Laos, up in the central part of a place called the Plain of Jars. There's a large, pretty good-sized town back then called Vietnam. On the runways, most of them were dirt, and they had steel matting down on it for planes to land on. The Russians used the same runways that we did. We drank in the same taverns that the Russians drank in. We shopped at the same stores. We knew the Russians. They knew us. But no, we didn't bother each other. They trained other people. We trained other people. It was just a close operation.
Was there more than one of these White Star teams?
There were several White Star teams, but they all worked in individual groups. And one group would never know what the other group was doing for the specific reason. Each group was on its own to a certain extent, but they did not know what the next group was doing in case they were captured, tortured, killed, or whatever. They could give nobody up.
Right. Did you ever hear the name Colonel Fletcher Prouty?
Yes, I did. Colonel Fletcher Prouty, he was the man in charge. Excellent man, excellent warrior, soldier, good leader.
You knew him?
I knew Colonel Fletcher Prouty personally, yes. Mr. Nicoletti asked me, said, if you back me up, Jimmy, he says, where do you think it'd be the best spot for you? And I said, well, the spot I like best is up on the grassy knoll behind that stockade fence. He says, why there? I said, I got the railroad yard for cover. I said, my clothes, I can turn my jacket inside out. I said, it's plaid on the inside. It looks like railroad workers. Somebody out there wearing a flannel shirt, nobody's going to pay no attention to me. I said, I can go over there, I can walk around a piece of chalk, walk up and down by boxcars, cross the railroad tracks, look at things. I'd just be another worker. Nobody'd even look at me. And he said, okay. He says, what weapon are you going to use over there? And I told him, and he, Chuck, I said, well, what's the situation? Chuck said, you know, we're going for a headshot now. I said, this I understand. I realize this. He said, you're not going to fire unless it becomes a necessity. He says, if I miss, he said, then it's going to be up to you. He said, but you don't fire, he said, unless I miss. He said, it's going to be your call at that point. He said, so you got to be very alert on this. And I told him, don't worry about me. I said, I got it, boss. And he said, what are you going to use? I said, I'm going to use the fireball. And he looked at me and says, why? Why the fireball? Now, the fireball, for people who don't know what a fireball is, it's like a cut-down rifle. It's actually basically this long. The weapon was well ahead of its time. This was one of the prototypes that the agency had got a hold of that had been manufactured by Remington. Now, a lot of people are going to tell you that this particular weapon was not available at that time, but this weapon was available. It didn't go on sale until a few years later, but this weapon had been manufactured as early as 1961. We had a lot of trouble with the barrel blowing up on it, used too big a round on it or something, overloads in it. A lot of problems with it, but they finally reinforced the barrel. We got it where it worked pretty good. And Chuck asked me, he says, why the fireball? So you've only got one shot, because the Remington Fireball 222 is a single-shot, bowl-action pistol, and you can mount a scope on it. Well, if I'm going to wait until you're through, I said, I'm only going to get one shot anyway, so it don't really matter. I said, because I'll never get a chance for a second shot if I wait until the last possible moment. He said, okay. He said, it's your call.
Where'd you get hold of a prototype weapon like the XP-100?
It was given to me by David Phillips. I'd received this maybe a year prior, 8 months, year prior to the assassination. The gun had been used twice before on assassinations, but nobody like a president or nothing. But it was good for using. You want to get into a close place area or somewhere, somebody might say, well, why use a pistol? Well, anybody that knows their weapons, this particular piece of sub is very accurate. Very accurate. It's up to 100 yards. At 100 feet, I'm talking about we're shooting now from the grassy knoll down to the highway to the street there, we're talking roughly 30, 35 yards. We're only talking 100 feet. This is like shooting fish in a barrel. And especially a little three-power scope on it. But the weapon had been used before, but you could put it in a briefcase, you could walk anywhere with it, nobody pay any attention to it. The case that I had set up, I had a little loading press inside for it, in case I had to manufacture anything, I had a little holder for all the special rounds that were in it. Everything was packed in foam rubber inside. The case was watertight, waterproof.
What did the case look like?
The case was black. It was like an oversized briefcase, basically speaking. And
leather on the outside.
Handle on a little metal flaps on it, you know, for locking it up. You could lock the case, but I wasn't concerned about locking it. But the thing is, you could take it, you could go anywhere, you look like a businessman with it. And I felt that was the best weapon to go with. And so Mr. Nicoletti agreed with me on it. He said, okay, it's your call, Jimmy. And that's what we agreed on. So then, like I say, the Dow Tech building, that had to have been previously arranged with them because they already had made arrangements to get the people in there. So the Dow Tech could not have been a last-minute decision as far as that goes, like me saying, okay, I think the Dow Tech building. He just used me as a sounding board.
Now, when you say had arranged to get you in the Downtex, I mean, that was an office building. Anybody could walk in and out. Mm-hmm. You're talking about getting into a specific
Into a specific office, into a specific area.
Make a statement.
Reason they needed somebody there to get them inside. Anybody could walk in and out. But the sole purpose of having a connection there, somebody that could get you into a place, into an office where you could open a door and you could have a window to shoot from. If you don't have an opening, don't do you no good to get in the building. You've got to be able to get into somebody's office. Office is not being used, nobody around. Otherwise, the door would be locked. You'd have no way in.
Do you happen to know which office that was?
No, I do not know which office it was.
What did you do?
What did I do? We rolled around there. We walked around the plaza for a little bit. Then I took him back over. I dropped Mr. Nicoletti back off at the Dallas Cabana. And he got with Johnny. They therefore went back over there. I told him where the car would be pulling alongside the building there and parked. He told me that they would come out of the building. They would get in that car. Now then, I did not drop Charles Nicoletti or Johnny Roselli off at the Daltech building. They got into the building. They were there on their own. I told him where the car would be. It's his car. He knows his car. He knows what my job is. They'll be in the car. He'll be in the front seat. Johnny will be in the back seat. I'll get under the driver's wheel. I'll set my briefcase between the front and the back seat. We'll drive away.
Where did you drop him off?
When we pulled out from the side of the building, I made a right and turned on to Houston. I believe that would be going north. I'm not sure now in my direction, but I made a right on Houston and went up Houston to a major intersection, about 4 or 5 blocks, maybe 6 blocks, whatever it was. Then I took a left-hand turn. I went down close to the freeway there, and there's a gas station there. I want to say Texaco, but it could have been something else. Might have even been a mobile. I'm not sure now. But they had a car there. This is where they told me to stop. This is where he told me he would be getting out at. You know, he said, go down here. We got a car waiting for us. And I drove down there. They opened the door. They got out. They started walking across the parking lot.
Now, this is before?
This is after the assassination.
After. Okay.
This is after the assassination.
Before. You said you didn't let them off at the Daltex.
And I took Charles Nicoletti back to the Dallas Cabana to meet with Johnny Roselli. Okay?
After you walked around Dealey
Plaza. After we walked around Dealey Plaza. There's still another hour to go probably before the assassination is going to go down.
Make that a statement. After we walked around for about an hour, I took Mr.
Nicoletti. After we walked around the Dealey Plaza, I took Mr. Nicoletti back to the hotel, let him out of the vehicle. He went up and got with Johnny Roselli. I took the car back to secure it where it's supposed to be, make arrangements. And he asked me, what if you can't get a parking space there? I told him, don't worry, I'll have a parking space. After I steal a car and move it out of there. I said, we'll be parked there. Just look for the car. And at this point, he told me, when we come out, he said, I want the car close so I can get in it right away. But he'd be carrying a rifle underneath his top coat, like his jacket, his top coat. And he would come out of there and secure that in the trunk. He'd put it in the trunk. He had to keep it in the trunk. He'd put that in the trunk, close the trunk. Johnny get in the back. Johnny Roselli would get in the back seat. He'd get in the passenger side. I'd come walking up. I'd get under the get in the driver's side. I'd enter my attaché case, briefcase, whatever you want to call it, gun case in between the front and the back seat. I'd get in, start the car, we'd drive away. I'd make a ride on Houston. I'd go down Houston. Several blocks there, I forget the intersection. Make a left-hand turn, go down by the gas station just before you get by the freeway there. And that'd be the Simmons Freeway at that area. And they got out of the car. They had a car waiting there. Which car it was, I don't know. Never watched them walk across the parking lot to it. As soon as they got out, the door closed, put it in gear, and I drove away. I went back to Mesquite, Texas.
Okay, again, though, that was after all the shooting.
That was after all the shooting.
Yeah.
After I took Charles Nicoletti back to the hotel, I went back to the plaza, secured the car, got my briefcase out with a gun in it, with a fireball in it. I went into the railroad yard. I secured that over there, put it away so nobody see it. Reversed my jacket inside out. I'd taken my hat, grape door like, and my jacket was a gray poplin. We had these car jackets back then. They were like waist length, not a short jacket, but they kind of come down a little bit. It's no car jacket like, made out of a material that they no longer use. It was called poplin. You might remember that material. The poplin material, grayish color, had a shine to it. Excuse me. That's what the jacket was like that I was wearing, a pair of gray pants with it. And I reversed the jacket and it had the offset plaids in it, like, you know, kind of like checkered on the inside. When I turned it over, it looked like one of the old gray flannel shirts that we used to wear out, you know, when you was doing work in the yard or something or another. Excuse me. And I walked around the railroad yard and I was waiting for the time to pass. Time was coming on. And When I heard the roar of the crowd, I'd been over by the fence, and I got there a little bit, a few minutes early. I'd reach down, I'd taken the scope off the weapon, and I'd look up, and I'd look over the fence, and I would looking for people. What I was looking for was not to see who I knew, but I was looking for people that would be carrying a bulge like up under their arm. I'm looking for somebody with a weapon. This way I have an idea.
Looking for security people?
I'm looking for security people. Cops, undercover, security, off duty, whoever might be carrying a weapon. Bulge along their hip, behind their back, like I say, under the arm in a shoulder holster. I'm looking for these little bulges. Most people don't pay no attention to that. But this is what I'm looking for. But then my amazement, I recognized several people out of the past that were in Dealey Plaza. Did I go talk to them? No. But I recognized them and seen them there.
Who was that?
I remember Oliveira. Remember seeing him there. A lot of people say Jack Ruby was never there, but he was there before the motorcade got there. I know that for a fact. And even though I didn't know Jack Ruby, but I was as close to him as I was you in the coffee shop, but I never spoke to him. I was never introduced to him. Never said a word to Jack Ruby. But I was that close. I'm looking at the back side of him, and I'm pretty sure that was him. Diaz was there. I believe his name was Tony. Tony Diaz is what I knew him as. Richard Kane, he was on scene. He was in the crowd. He had been there early. He was leaving. He was walking like away. Philip Alarezo, I know he was there that day. Where he went, I have no idea. But there were several people that I saw.
How about Frank Sturgis?
Frank Sturgis, he was there.
How did you know Frank Sturgis?
I knew Frank Sturgis from the Bay of Pigs and from the SAO. I also knew Orlando Bosch. He was on scene. Orlando Bosch. I don't know if you're familiar with his name or not, but he was also present. And there's a few other faces I recognized. I just don't remember the names for them because it's so long ago.
How do you figure all those people were in Dealey Plaza?
You know, I couldn't figure that one out myself, but it's like anything else. It's like everybody, they know something's going to happen. Maybe they know a building's going on fire or something. You know, you got a building burning and may collapse. Everybody runs to see the fire. They should be going the other way. About the only time I've ever seen a lot of confusion was where people were trying to get away, like if you're the racetracker in a crowded place and somebody yelled gun, everybody broke and stampeded. And we had a few people out the racetrack get hurt that way there out at Maywood Park that got hurt in a stampede like that. But basically speaking, if somebody knows something's going to happen, they have a tendency to go see it. Most people are curious. You know, you ever drive down the highway, you see a wreck? You're probably guilty of it. You slow the car down, look out the window. Everybody does it. So a lot of people come there for that reason, probably because they had heard these rumors and stuff that he was going to be assassinated in Dallas. That was no secret. Right. Even the National Security Agency knew that.
What about Eugene Braden?
Eugene Braden? He was there that day. He was the... Eugene Braden was there for a specific reason. He had the contacts inside the Dow Tech building. And he was the one that Charles Nicoletti and Johnny Roselli needed to get him into the private office somewhere or another. I have no idea where that office was. I was never in the Dow Tech building myself, so I can't even describe anything in there.
So you probably stood behind that fence there for some little time.
I stayed away from the fence. I stayed basically in the yard, walk over the fence, look over it, spend a minute, then walk back away again. I was observing the area.
Were you a smoker at the time?
Oh, yes, I did smoke.
Were you smoking cigarettes that morning?
I had smoked that day. Careless. I probably stepped on several cigarette butts and left them there. Most of them Pall Mall.
Was it muddy back there?
It was very muddy. Let me put it this way. I, a couple of times, even took my shoes, put them up on the little concrete ledge and scraped the mud off the bottom of them.
What clothes was getting mud on. Frank Sturgis wearing?
I don't remember exactly the clothes. I remember he had on like a bomber jacket. Remember the World War II bomber jackets the pilots used to wear? He was wearing one like that. Like that, like the one you got right there. His had the brass buttons on it. Remember that. You can see that flashing, you know.
Which location of Dealey Plaza was he standing?
I was where you got the concrete steps to go down by the pergola there, and between the pergola and the stockade fence, you got a set of concrete steps to go down. I was to the right of those.
Draw me a map.
I got to put my glasses on for that.
Have you got them with you?
Yeah, but I don't want to sit here drawing. It's going to take too much time up.
Okay.
But he is to the left and just off of the sidewalk. He was standing in the grass itself.
And this was shortly before the assassination?
This was just a few minutes before the motorcade got there. But like I say, before the motorcade ever arrived on scene and I took the scope off, I didn't have the gun up over the fence. I didn't want nobody to panic at that point. But I had a little scope up my hand. I could look over the fence and I could kind of check to see who it was. I was looking, like I said, I was looking for security people, you know, for somebody carrying, somebody packing. Because I want to know who's got weapons when I go to leave there.
That fence kind of makes an L shape, you know.
Yeah, it's on and off, yeah. It's long arrow to short arrow, but it's not exactly an L, it's on a slant, 45, like 45 degrees. I was, 8 to 10 feet down there. There was a tree branch that hung right over me. I was behind that, kind of giving me a little camouflage.
Okay. Did you ever see an ambulance come by?
No, I never paid no attention. I wasn't watching the vehicles that passed by. I'm looking at people. I never noticed an ambulance.
You didn't see an ambulance with red lights?
No, I heard, might have heard a siren. I don't remember. I had all that tuned out. I'm in another complete mode. Sirens, lights flashing, ambulances, police. That don't bother me. I'm not there to look for those things. I'm there looking for other details for other things.
Okay, so then what happened? The motorcade came?
I'm checking everything. I got most everybody, and just basically where a lot of different people are standing at. And I want to make sure that there's, like I say, I don't have any cops right next to me because, you know, something happens and I have to shoot. You know, I don't want to have to shoot anybody else unless it becomes a necessity. So I walk away from the fence. I come back over, secured everything, got it ready. I could hear the rumble, the people murmuring. So you know the motorcade's approaching. So then I got ready, opened it up. I'm holding the Remington Fireball down below the fence at this point. Motorcade come down, I believe that's Main Street there, come down on Houston, turn back around onto Elm there, and come down that little side drive there. Oh, when it come down and made its first right, that's when I brought the weapon up. And then I'm over the fence, and as they come down, made the turn on down there, that's when I started focusing through the scope and following the car. As shots started ringing out, I started counting the shots, but I'm not counting like one, two, three, and four. I'm counting them miss, 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 because I know we're going for the headshot. So I don't care how many rounds are being fired as long as we get a headshot. But I'm hearing the shots being fired, and I'm counting them as a miss, miss. And that's the only thing I'm concerned about. I've got this sign there for the Simmons Freeway that is fixing to come into my field of fire. As far as I can see at this point, the president has not been hit in the head at this time. I've seen the body lurch. I know he's been hit. How serious, I don't know. But my last instructions was we're going for headshot. If you have to take a shot, take it. But don't fire unless it's a necessity, unless you really have to. He said, Jimmy, don't fire unless you have to. We want everything from the backside. I'm not asking why. Okay, whatever you say. At this point, as it starts to approach and come behind that freeway sign, and I've already been instructed not to hit anybody but Kennedy because they didn't want Jackie getting hurt or anybody else, I'm fixing to lose my field of fire. And at this point, either I shoot or I can put it in a suitcase and leave, one or the other. I took the shot. I fired one shot only.
And where were you aiming?
I was aiming for his right eye, which to me is the left side of his head looking head on. But for him, it would be his right eye. And once I pull the trigger, I'm right in on it, and it's almost like looking 6 feet away through the scope. As I squeezed, take off my round, his head moved forward, I missed, and I come in right along the temple, just right behind the eye.
Here or in the hairline?
No. All right. Well, I'm not sure because I can't see the penetration. I know I hit him right here. I know I hit behind the eye, somewhere within a half inch diameter right there, say. But
two shots almost simultaneously.
You think he got hit as you were screaming?
What I believe is this, and I got my ratings as a marksman. I'm a good shooter, always was. And I'm not bragging on myself, don't get me wrong, but that's what got me my start with David Phillips because of something that I did in the service. And I made a mark there, and it's on record, and it's recorded for headshots for what I did and the things that I did. But anyway, to make a long story short, as I was preparing to squeeze off my round, Kennedy's head moved forward just as I squeezed. It was already in process. The head started forward. To me, what I believe is, and I did not see, let me clear the fact now, I never saw Mr. Nicoletti shoot Kennedy, but I know he was the man in the Dowtech building, the man supposed to be doing the shooting. Therefore, the head started forward. As far as I'm concerned, Mr. Nicoletti hit him at that point. As I squeezed off my round, the head started forward. I hit it and blew the head backwards.
So the exit wounds where in the rear?
I didn't hit the rear. The exit blew out. And you can see Jackie.
But
where
was the exit? On the right side or the left side?
Partially, most of it on his right side, I guess, back there where the section come right out, part of the back of the skull. You know, I didn't go look at it. I didn't examine it. And a lot of people may find this hard to believe, but I have never read anything on the Kennedy assassination because I was never interested in it. I did not like John F. Kennedy.
Did you ever see autopsy pictures?
Did I ever see one?
The autopsy pictures?
They sent me a book with. I looked at a few of them, but I didn't read the book. I want to say the book they sent me was probably called High Treason. I never read it. I looked at a few of the pictures. I just wasn't interested.
Can I show you a picture and ask you for your comment? Mm-hmm.
Where is it? You're going to make me put my glasses on.
Yeah. That's one. What do you think of that picture? That's the back of Kennedy's head.
From what I'm looking at here, looks like part of the flap on the side is missing. But I don't see very much in this picture here, the back of the head missing. What I'm looking at here is a lot of hair.
So what's your conclusion?
What's my conclusion? That ain't the right picture.
Okay.
Thank you.
That's my conclusion. You want my opinion on it? That's not the right picture. The photo that I just looked at, in my opinion, that's a fake picture. That is not the real picture. A lot of people might say you can't see nothing through a scope. But I'm going to tell you something. When you see something burst, his head like a watermelon, you're going to see pieces of stuff flying in different directions, and people are going to be splattered by it. At this point, I got to figure, well, she's going to be picking up a piece of his skull or something, because a lot of people say you can't see nothing through a scope like this. But what you're going to see is like, and I saw it, the head explode. I saw the backside come out. I seen brains or whatever you want to call it, tissue, hair, a whole thing going everywhere, just a spray. And if anybody displeases, just go out and shoot somebody and look through a scope while you're doing it and watch.
Look at this blue.
Yeah. And did one other thing I'd like
to... Did you see anybody splattered with blood?
I don't know who was splattered. I think one of the agents, probably one of the Secret Service agents riding on the back of the car. I'm only assuming that. I would say they probably got splattered because there was stuff everywhere. But one of the other things I want to point out about Remington 222 Fireball, it's a high-velocity pistol. The round travels approximately 3,180 feet per second. Now then, for this type of weapon, there is very little recoil. Now, a lot of people say there's a lot of recoil, it's going to jump, you can't see nothing. And I've had a lot of criticism over the years over this here. So I'd like for somebody to go out to firing range somewhere, gun store, and take one of these particular types of weapons and carry a 222 round and fire. You're going to find very little recoil, especially when you're using an extended barrel weapon with a scope on it. You got the weight to hold it down. It's not jumping and bouncing. You're not shooting a 44 or 45.
We have verified all that.
Okay, but...
Okay, so did the motorcade ever come to a stop?
The motorcade, the best of my recollection, to me and my mind and everything is slowed down at this point. When the first shot went off, it's like it stopped. It's just like it slowed down almost to crawl or barely moving, or maybe it even stopped. I'm not really sure on that point. I know I was waiting. It kept moving. It had to have been moving, but very, very slow. Because I'm waiting for it to get up the sand. I'm waiting for something to happen so I don't have to shoot. Not that I'm afraid to, but if I don't have to, I don't want to. But like I say, when the car got even, almost up to that Simmons Freeway sign there, and that was one of the most, and ain't like these new ones they got today with nice little skinny metal posts and a little sign. These here had, made it, I guess, the wooden legs on, or what do you want to call it? The post to hell, it was wood. Anyway, I had my shot. It's either I shoot now or I don't. I took my shot.
Did you ever notice if any of those rounds hit that sign?
No. I don't know if anybody else's did or not. As far as I know, their round never hit it. I know my round didn't hit it. Like I say, I fired one shot.
But
I was on target.
Sign, so.
No. I'm watching one thing. Through that scope, I'm watching one thing. I'm watching President John F. Kennedy.
So if a bullet hit the sign, you probably wouldn't have seen it anyway.
No. I didn't even know Cummings was hit at that point of the game.
Were you nervous in any way?
Was I nervous? No. If I'd have been nervous, I'd have been shaking. I couldn't have made the shot. A lot of people may find this hard to believe, but you've got to understand something. First time you go into the field of fire, when you go into a firefight in combat, you might be nervous or skimmish. But after you've been initiated into the field of fire, whatever you want to call it, combat, firefights, a lot of people got different names for it, skirmishes.
You get
over it. And, and to me, and a lot of people are really going to think I'm probably sick, but when you got into a firefight, that was element high. I've never used drugs in my life. A firefight to me, being in the service, that was one of the greatest things there was. It was the ultimate high. And at this point, when you're stalking down somebody, and this particularly, they stopped me from hunting animals altogether. When I was young, I used to love to go shoot deer, rabbit, squirrel, whatever I could get, pheasant. But after you went into the jungles and you've hunted man and you've stalked a man down and you've hunted a man down on equal terms where he can kill you, you have no desire to go shoot a defenseless animal. I become to where I loved animals much more than that. I couldn't kill an animal. When my dog had to be put to sleep, my wife and one of my top right-hand men had to take the dog to the vet because I didn't have the heart to do it.
Were there any, while you were up behind that fence, mostly before the shooting started, was there anyone in your vicinity?
There was nobody behind that stockade fence but me at that point. Nobody. All the time I was there, I was alone. But in front of the fence, the two people that I was mostly concerned about, was a couple of guys wearing suits, they were up there on top of the grassy knoll there, and they were a little ways in front, maybe 15, 20 feet away, whatever, you know. I did not know who they were.
In front of the fence would be the railroad yard.
So. Yeah, but the stockade fence. No, the stockade fence.
Between the fence and the road.
They're between the fence and the sidewalk, between me and the motorcade. Okay. They're on top, they're at the top of the knoll there. Okay. They're kind of like looking over everybody and watching people. And this had me a little bit concerned, because I don't know who they are. At this stage of the game, well, I'm going to take my shot. I got the 45 ready. If I got two, like I say, I don't want to shoot nobody unless I have to. At this point, and I've checked them, the shoulder holsters, the backside, I saw no bulges. As far as I knew, they wasn't packing. So I figured maybe they're just a couple of businessmen. People want to see the president go by. A lot of people are strange that way. Everybody wants to go see celebrities go by. But I took the shot, and as I was walking away, and like I said, I seen Jackie crawl out there. Motorcycle cop, he threw his bike down. He jumped off, and as he come running in a little zigzag or whatever you want to call it, like he's really into combat or something, he's still a wide open target. Anybody could shoot him. He's got his pistol out. And he's running up the hill there. The two men that at the fence there, seen two guys in the suits, they go over and they open up identifications. So I have to figure these are probably my cover that I've never been informed about. And I was told not to worry. They stopped him, and he never came no farther. He went back down off the knoll.
You were told not to worry.
I was told, Charles Nicoletti told me, he said, when you take the shot, he said, just walk away. He told me, don't run. He said, just walk away natural, Jimmy. He said, don't show no attention. I told him, I said, don't worry. And I had no intention of breaking out of there running. But like I say, if somebody comes at me, I'm willing to do whatever I have to do to leave the area. If that shoots somebody else, that's what I'll do at this point of the game.
You said 10, 15 feet or so down from the corner towards the railroad.
8 or 10 feet, something like that, yeah. From the end where the...
Were you close to halfway between, in the halfway mark of that fence?
No, I wasn't in the middle of the fence. You got your left angle that comes, and you got about a 45-degree angle for the short part of the fence.
Yeah.
Then I'm down maybe 10 feet from there.
Okay.
And there's a tree branch. One branch come right down up the tree there. It covered
so
real good.
Halfway points on down to your
halfway
right.
Is a little more down to my right.
Okay.
That would have been halfway down.
Did you ever notice a GI, a guy in a khaki uniform?
No, I did not.
Did you notice people on the railroad bridge?
I knew there's people up there, but I didn't pay any attention to them.
They didn't have a good view of you anyway, because you were under
yeah,
the
they were,
cover.
I'm pretty well undercover. The only time people could see me from the viaduct or from the railroad yard is when I was walking down the tracks next to some of the boxcars.
But as you recall it, nobody was with you behind the fence.
I said before, like, there was nobody behind the stockade fence with me. I am the only person back there. Anybody else back there is over in the railroad yard by the trains.
How about down by that corner down there? Did you have a clear view? There's a lot of cars back there, right?
Yeah.
Did you have a clear view? Could somebody have been down around by that corner and you might not have seen?
They could have been down there. A couple of cars drove through while I was there, but who they were and what kind they were, I don't even remember because I just wrote it off. As long as nobody got out, nobody come by me, they're no concern.
But shortly before, there was no...
Right before the assassination, there was nobody standing next to me.
How about... 3 minutes before the assassination, you don't...
Not by me. Okay. I was alone back there. Okay. I had no other party standing by me. If somebody was there in the yard or down at the other end, 30, 40 feet away, that has no bearing to me because I paid them no attention.
Well, there's this eyewitness report of the guy in the railroad tower. Mm.
Well, he might have been the tower, but I'm talking about people on the ground walking up by me or passing me. Or...
No, but he's describing two persons behind the fence. Wow. One fits your description.
Mm-hmm. But, well, maybe he's figuring two people when he see me change my jacket and walk away somebody different. I don't know. But I was alone, and there was nobody with me.
Okay. All right, so after you walk away and these two guys cover for you, describe your actions then.
Oh, as I'm walking away, I've got my briefcase, gun case in my right hand. I've got my left hand over by my coat pocket. I got a Colt 45 there. I've got it fully loaded with 6 rounds in it. It's ready to go if I need it.
When you reversed your jacket.
I've already reversed my jacket. When I picked up the gun case, I reversed my jacket, no plaid side. I got the poplin gray material on the outside. I took the fedora I had shoved down in the sleeve of it, snapped it out, put it back on my head, and I walked away. Here in the briefcase, and my .45 inside my coat pocket.
How long did it take to do that?
Just a few seconds. Don't take long.
Is that any chance that that's you walking along right there?
I had the blow up for you.
The blow up's even worse. It's just a blob.
This would be probably 15, 30 seconds.
Looking at that, I couldn't say it's me, but I'm saying you can see somebody there. Basically speaking, it could have been.
Is that the direction you took?
Yeah.
You walked back towards the deposit.
Right. Going in that direction.
And there was nobody around you at that point?
At that point, there's nobody around me. I'm not going to let nobody get close to me at that point. Because, like I say, somebody might try to grab me. They might want to pull a gun on me. I'm looking at people. Somebody turns around. If they make the wrong move, if I see somebody pulling a weapon, they're going to be shot. If I see somebody...
This is a little retaining wall,
mm-hmm.
and right on the other side of it's a sidewalk,
mm-hmm.
and then there's like a little, little garden patch, little flower garden thing, and then that road, the little road that runs in front of the depository.
Right. That's the one that comes at the dead end down here?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the one.
And that's right where you were walking.
That's right where I was walking.
You're on the south side or the north side?
I don't remember.
Don't remember.
Okay. All I remember is I'm walking and I'm watching over my shoulder. I'm trying to see if anybody's coming at me.
Do you have a Mormon picture there?
Yeah.
Well, look at that later.
I think it did. Yeah, no, we might as well look at this right here.